Okay, so what I want to do here is just try to trace some of the nature of the holiday of Purim and Hanukkah, which are sort of the two classic rabbinic holidays, and how the principles behind them were used by poskim in the state of Israel to justify the creation of Yom HaTzmaut, and how they really, in many ways, are a natural continuation of Purim and Hanukkah. I gave a version of this shir at a Midrash Yom Rishon earlier in the year. Here I've added to highlight the issues that are unique to Purim. So the first two sources in the here focus specifically on the arguments that the Gemara gives when it's describing why Purim and Hanukkah were made into holidays. So if you look in the first source, this is the Gemara's justification for Purim being made into a rabbinic holiday. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Arbaim Ushmona Nevi'im V'sheva Nevi'ot Nabu Lahem Li'Israel. There were 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses who prophesized, or prophesied, which is the technical word for it, for the Jewish people. And none of them added or subtracted from the Torah, except for the Megillah. And my drosh, and what? How did they expound? How did they derive that this was legitimate to create a new holiday? Where did they get this basis in the Torah? So, Amar B'chia Barav and Amar Shuv Ben Karcha, they got it from Pesach. Uma me avdut lecheirut amrin and shira. If we're obligated to sing and say Hallel for Pesach when we were just free, so we went from slavery to freedom. So, mimita lechayim lo kol shekein. So, from death to life, our lives were actually saved. How much more so do we need to create some sort of without Dan, we might have to open the door. Yeah. So
one door I think is open.
Oh yeah? Okay. Oh, is there? Okay.
The left door.
So how much more so when we were saved from death do we have to sing Hallel? And Chazal assume that the Megillah is not just publicizing the miracle, but in fact itself is an expression of Hallel, of thanking God. Two is the Gemara by Hanukkah. And the Gemara says, "My Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? What was it? Why was it instituted? Ditana Rabbanan b'chafei b'kislev yomei de Hanukkah temnaya inun. From the 25th of Kislev, we have 8 days of Hanukkah. Dlo misbad b'hom lo lichtanot b'hon. Or we don't eulogize, we don't fast. And why? Because when the Greeks came in to the Beis HaMikdash, Timu Kol Hashmanu Shebeichal, so they contaminated all the oil. And when the Chashmonaim overwhelmed them and they beat them, they only found one thing of oil, which had the seal of the Kohen Gadol, and it only had enough oil for one day, so they lit for 8 days. The next year, so next year they instituted a holiday with thanksgiving and with praise to God. So these are the two Gemarot that explain how we instituted the holiday of Purim and the holiday of Hanukkah. In Purim, we specifically justify it based on a comparison, or really a kal v'chomer, an a fortiori from Pesach, where we say that the Torah justified creating a holiday because we became free. And then we say that if that was the case, then for sure we can create a holiday when our lives were saved. And in the case of Hanukkah, we describe this miracle, and because of this miracle, so we created a holiday. So from here we have precedent for creating new holidays post Chumash, one which is still in Tanakh, which is the Megillah, and one even post the closing of the canon of Tanakh, which is Hanukkah, creating new holidays when miracles happen to us. Now,
the curious thing is the expression that's used here is not that we have a holiday when we go from slavery to freedom, But we sing Hallel. That's exactly what we don't do.
Well, the Gemara says, right, Hallel is, we express it through the Megillah, and Megillah is the essence of the day. But yes, right, that's the, that's the, right.
Just that particular
correct. Word. If we went through the whole thing, and, you know, that how we get from Hallel being a being fulfilled through the Megillah is the whole discussion there. Gemara is much lengthier, but the basic principle is emerged from the Gemara. Now, if we just skip for a moment, Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out that it doesn't. It's not simply that we have two holidays. But if you skip here to 7, there's no really good way of organizing this because we're going to need it again. But we'll skip for a moment to 7. So this is the Rabbi Soloveitchik noted that if you look in the Rambam, when the Rambam organizes the halachot of Purim and Chanukah, he calls the halachot Hilchot Megillah uChanukah. And he starts, the first two chapters deal with Purim, and the second two chapters deal with Chanukah. Now, Shulchan Aruch doesn't do that. Shulchan Aruch has Hilchot Chanukah first, and then Hilchot Purim, because Shulchan Aruch goes according to the calendar year. But the Rambam doesn't. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asked, why was it that the Rambam put Purim before Chanukah, and why both in the title and in terms of the organization? So he says, if you look at here the second paragraph here, which is Perek Gimel, Halacha Gimel. So the Rambam says, "Umipnei mat hitkinu chachamim shivoto ador shihu shmonat hayamim ha'elu shetchilatan milel chamisha ve'esrim v'kislev yimei simcha v'halel mumadlikin mehen ha'neirot be'erev al pitchei abatim v'chol laila u'laila mishmona ha'leilot laharot l'galot ha'neis." For this reason, they set the sages of that generation set up the 8 days of Chanukah to celebrate and to sing and to light the candles. V'yamim elu heina nikra'in Chanukah. This is what we call Chanukah. V'hein asurin behesped v'ta'anit. And it's forbidden it to eulogize or to fast. Kin mei ha'purim. Like Purim. V'adlakot ha'neirot bahen. And the lighting of the candles. Mitzvah midivrei sofrim kikriyat ha'megillah. Is a mitzvah like the reading of the Megillah. So Rabbi Soloveitchik notes that, in fact, Purim is the paradigm of all rabbinic holidays. It's not that there's Chanukah and Purim. Purim actually starts everything. Right? So this Gemara in, and that he says, if you look at the Rambam, that's what the Rambam says explicitly, right? That Chanukah was instituted like Purim, and the Neirot are like Megillah. So really, the paradigm, what proves that there's this notion that we can create new holidays is Purim. The fact that canonized into Tanakh is Megillas Esther, which has a discussion of the new Chagim, and that Esther and Mordechai compelled the Jewish people to institute new days and Yudalit and Tezvav of Adar. The fact that that is canonized into Tanakh is what proves that Jews are allowed to and even mandated to continue to create holidays. And all future holidays that will be created post Chumash are going to be modeled after Purim. Right, so Purim becomes the model, the paradigm for rabbinic holidays, and as we'll see, for personal holidays as well. Now, the Gemara in Source 3, this is the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, has a discussion of a series of other holidays that used to exist, both holidays and fast days, and discusses whether, in fact, they're still binding today. So the Gemara there says as follows, Idmar, Rav Rabbi Chanina Amri, Batla Megillat Ta'anit. So there was a book called Megillat Ta'anit. You can find it. You can get hard copies of it. I think Arskol came out with one, which listed a list of fast days and a list of holidays, when it was usher to fast, when it was forbidden to eulogize, etc. Days like Purim. So Rav Rav Chanina said, once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, so all the holidays that are listed there become null and void. Rabbi Yochanan and Yeshua ben Levi Amrei, Rabbi Yochanan says, no, lo batla Megillat Ta'anit, it's not true. So Rav Rav Chanina Amrei, batla Megillat Ta'anit, it is nullified, and Hachi Ka'amar, what does it mean? It means like this, Bizman Shi Shalom, Yehu L'Sason L'Liv Simcha. When there is peace, so then these fast days will become holidays. Ein shalom tzom. And if there is no peace, then those same holidays will be fast days. V'hanachna mikihani. And these days now are on the same footing. Yochanan Rishu ben Levi. I mean, lo bad lo megillat ta'anit. It wasn't nullified. And hani hu detlinu rachman and vinyan ben hamikdash. Aval hanach kidekaimi kaimi. He said, it's not true. Some of them are in fact nullified, but some of them remain unaffected. So Mazir Rav Kahana. So he challenged him. He said, "What is that? Masav Gazer Tanit b'Chanukah b'Lud. Is it true that all the holidays in Megillat Tanit are nullified? One of them is Chanukah, and it was happened. They made a fast on Chanukah. V'yarad Rabbi Elazar v'Rachatz. And Rabbi Elazar went and he bathed himself. Rabbi Shua v'Siper. Rabbi Shua went and cut his hair to show that the holiday of Chanukah was still in effect, and therefore you weren't allowed to fast, you weren't allowed to institute a public fast. So, va'amru lahem suvit anam mashi shehitanitem, and he said to the people who did fast, you have to fast again to atone for the fact that you fasted. So, amr of Yosef, shayni chanukah de'ika mitzvah. Chanukah is unique because it has a mitzvah. Amr le'abaye v'tivatel ihi. So why don't you get rid of Chanukah as well, v'tibatel mitzvata, and then the mitzvah won't apply like the other holidays that are listed in Megillat Ta'anit. Right, these were all holidays that were relevant at the time of the Beit HaMikdash, but now are not, because after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, there's no reason to celebrate in these days. So, El Amar of Yosef, Shaini Chanukah de Mefarsem Nisa, it says Chanukah is different because it publicizes a miracle. So what emerges from this Gemara is that there were these lists of holidays, of celebrations, of miracles that had happened. But once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we no longer benefited from those miracles. So those minor holidays ceased to be important, ceased to be relevant. But Chanukah and Purim, that's not true. They maintain their importance because their miracles were in some way unique. So what you see from this Gemara is another level to it, which was there were mini Purim and Chanukahs, shall we say, which existed temporarily, but ceased to exist when they weren't relevant to people's lives. But Chanukah and Purim are unique. So we add to this that there are something about Chanukah and Purim are unique, that they are eternally relevant, but there's also a notion of setting up Purim and Chanukah-like holidays for personal, let's say, miracles or temporary miracles, which don't have universal importance, but could potentially have importance in your own time. And that's what emerges from this Gemara. So this leads to a discussion in the Maram al Shakar and the Chassam Sofer in 4 and 5, which we'll skim, as to whether in fact it's true that you're allowed to create personal holidays. So if you look in source 4, I didn't translate these because I don't want to get bogged down in them, but we'll just skim through them. So the Maram al Shakar was asked as follows. So he was asked a question: the Finto Shela and Sheir Achad Heim veBeit Dinam Tiknu Binehem Bechamod Vaskama Gedola Lehem VaAlzaram VaKol Baim Achareim Me'ata VeRolam LaSod Et Yom Echad Asar Yom LaChodesh Teveit Ki Yom Purim LaChol Dvarav Kedil Farseim Neis Echad Gadol Shnaseh Lahem Boto Yom. There was this town that had contacted the Maram al Shakar and said that they had a custom to make a personal Purim. And this was a custom in many, many places when there was a miracle in your town to create a holiday and call it a Purim Katan.
So when is this?
Maram al Shakar.
Yeah.
He is, I think he's 17th century, I want to say.
Oh, so it's recent.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think he's 16th or 17th century. Right. Relatively recently. And the next one we'll see is Chassam Sofer. So now we're talking right 19th century.
Okay.
And they had made the decree that not only the people living in the city, but their children, even if they would move to another city, would have to follow this holiday. Are they allowed to do that or not? And even if they could make it for their own generation, can they make it for future generations? And even if they could do it for their children, is that only true when they live in the city, or even if they get exiled into other cities, is it binding on their children wherever they might be in any city? So explain to me the nature of the custom. So he said, Shuva, he says, for sure, you can in fact set up new holidays, and you can punish the people who don't follow it. V'davar muskamu min afarshim, and it's clear in the commentators. Ukvar katav Rash Bazal, d'tzibur kebeidin shel b'nei ramein, v'chol shekein b'nidon shelanush shetiknu takanatam heimu v'edinam, v'in basa mimidat din Torah. He said, for sure, their court has that power, and this is not against the Torah. Adarabah. On the contrary, sheyesh ba pirsumei nisa, it publicizes the miracle. Now that language he obviously steals from
Hanukkah.
Hanukkah and Purim, right? In other places, I didn't put the one for Purim, but that is how the Gemara in Megillah Daf Gimel explains why we read the Megillah. Shecholin l'taken l'taken v'takanat v'tikin he. They can set up egzera, and it is considered ancient. And establish. And he proves, he said, look, Chazal in Meseches Brachos have a bracha, a blessing that you make if a miracle happens to you. You say, Omer Baruch Shasai Imi Neis B'Makom Hazeh. Say, blessed is God who made a miracle for me here. So if there's an institution by which you can halachically give significance to a miracle that happened to you, then for sure a city that had a public miracle happen to them, they can set up a holiday. They can do it for all generations, even if they don't explicitly say it's for all generations. They don't mention their children when they institute. They can make it for themselves, for their children, etc. And then he says, and what about when they leave? Says Ibravade Komishahed Tik Diratoma Komachar Vala Durba Komacher, the Ain Dato La Shuvar, so the Aino Nalav Kumre Makom, Shiatsami Shamal Shaneg Minhago Toma Kom Shalach Lasham. Normally we say that once you move out of a city, you don't take the customs with you. So nearly the Khimd Naizehu Katuv ba baskamatan beferush tafil shanut mikomam lo paka minayu totakana al korchan dechalalem valbaim acharem b'chol makom shiyu. Since here they explicitly said that it would apply to their children wherever they are, so in fact it is binding. Baskamatem alehem valzaram b'chol inyan shiye kidvirirna. So the Maram al Shakar sets this precedent, right? I mean, he doesn't set the precedent; he records this precedent. And that there was this custom for people to set up what was called a Purim Katan, for a personal miracle or a citywide miracle, and not just a holiday for you, but for your children, wherever they might be, even if they don't live in that city anymore. And that was considered legitimate. The Chasam Sofer in 5 was asked this question again, specifically to relate to the Tshuva of the Maram Shakar. He's asked, can a tzibur or an individual, can a community or individual set up a holiday when a miracle is done, relating to this Tshuva of the Maram Shakar? So he writes that the Pri Chadash thought you couldn't. So he writes, if you look at the second paragraph here in Source 5, he says, but Amram Pri Chadash, quoting the Kunjas Minhagim, he was skipped down, he said that he rejects the Maram al-Shakar. He says you can't. Why? I'll summarize it outside. And he says, the Gemara that we just read that said, Batla Megillah Ta'anit. So he says, what does that mean? That means that post the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, all holidays, besides for Purim and Hanukkah, cease to be not just relevant. You can't make new holidays post the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. The only non-biblical holidays you can have are Purim and Hanukkah. But if you skip to the second, into the third paragraph now, the Chasam Sofer rejects it. He says, no, Lufiani Adati, the letel chodvar avzal, he's wrong. He said, what does the Gemara mean there? The Gemara may have entertained at the beginning the possibility that you can't make holidays post Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. But he said, the conclusion of the Gemara seems to be that any holiday which is no longer relevant, meaning any holiday that was pre-destruction of Beit HaMikdash, so we don't celebrate anymore. But not that a holiday that would continue to be relevant couldn't be created. So the reason Purim and Hanukkah continue to be celebrated is not because there's something magical, but because they continue to teach us lessons forever. So let's say a miracle would happen to us. So just like they could make holidays in the time of Megillat Ta'anit, and when they ceased to be relevant, they ceased to be holidays. But during that time, when they were still meaningful, they were holidays. So too, we're always allowed to make holidays. And that's how he understands the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. And then in the last paragraph, he ties it back to the Gemara we opened with. And he said, that in fact is the argumentation that the Gemara itself used, that just like Pesach, we made a holiday because we were saved from slavery, Purim, we make a holiday because we were saved from death, which tells you that every time we're saved from death, there was a miracle, we have to set up a holiday. And if you look in 6, this is in another tshuva where he's summarizing his position. So you see it in 2 lines. He says, what's the summary of his position? Kviat yom moed biyom asiyat nes hukal vachomer d'oraita. Setting up a holiday on a day that a miracle happened is an a fortiori biblically. And for that reason, even though Purim and Hanukkah are rabbinic holidays, they fulfill the biblical value that we derived from Pesach. The rabbinic aspect is just how do you celebrate them? Im l'shalach manot, whether you should send mishloach manot, or l'hadlik neirot, or to light candles, or l'azot zacher acher, or to do something else. Zeu derabanan, that's the rabbinic aspect. Va'over eina oseh shum zecher l'mechanako purim, over al mitzvah aseh d'oraita. But one who doesn't in any way commemorate a miracle violates the biblical command. So, if you take it together, what the Chasam Sofer argues, and if we take Rabbi Soloveitchik's argument as well, what you have is Pesach acts as the model of all holidays. That we are biblically mandated to create a holiday when a miracle happens to us. The rabbis were then faced in the time of Purim the question of can we post Bible, right, biblical period, set up holidays? And they made a simple argument. If Pesach was a holiday in which we became free, then obviously if our lives are saved, we must be able to create a holiday. Purim therefore set a precedent for forever that we can set up or should set up holidays that express our thanks when God makes a miracle for us. Once Purim was canonized, so the rabbis in the time of Hanukkah built on that precedent and created Hanukkah. Those two remain eternal holidays that teach us lessons forever. As the Bach would say, and I didn't put it, but this is the famous thing that everyone always quotes, right? Purim established the precedent that we set up holidays when we're saved physically, and Hanukkah set up the precedent that we can set up a holiday when we're saved spiritually. In addition to these, yeah?
So, the idea then is that, I mean, if we were to take a look at our history of the 3,500 years, probably every single day of the calendar, you could find an excuse for having a holiday. You could also have an excuse for a day of mourning. But, we pick and we choose. So I understand the saying, when you have a miracle which happens, you have an obligation to set up a holiday. But then the key words of the idea, whether the Megillat Tanit was not valid, or was not valid, depends on whether it's still relevant or not.
Correct.
Well, of course, we learn things from Hanukkah. I mean, for sure, we're doing lots of learning at Purim now, and I wouldn't question that. I mean, there are obviously lessons which we take from it. But if we look at it directly, like, is it really relevant in the sense that it affects that what happened at Purim, the fact that they were saved at that time?
Right. So I think specifically, so the way Gemara seems to present is, at least Hanukkah and Purim, they're considered relevant because their messages are relevant, right? The Gemara's language by Hanukkah, or the argument of the Gemara's language by Hanukkah is that Mefarse Misa continues to publicize the miracle. Presumably what that means is that Hanukkah and Purim have eternal messages to them. Right.
In number six, the Chatam Sofer doesn't seem to require that the messages be eternal. He just said if there's a miracle.
Right, so this is his summary of number five. Right, he references you back to number five.
Okay.
Right, where in number five he says Hanukkah and Purim are those right paradigms, and then the Megillat Ta'anit esque holidays, the local holidays, right, and that's the next stage. Now, Hanukkah and Purim are also unique in the sense that they're actually national holidays. Right, they were national miracles. Right, the cases of Megillat Ta'anit tended not to be. They tended to be more local issues. Right, and therefore they really lose their relevance. Right, national things. Right, we commemorate. Right, even if. Right.
Okay.
Right, national things continue to have messages in a way that local things don't. But the fact that Purim and Hanukkah exist set a precedent that a local community could choose or should choose to set up a holiday for themselves. Now, in the model of Megillat Ta'anit, where they would only be relevant, you know, to those, to the people, as far, you know, as long as the it was relevant to the community, with, you know, discussions of what if they're living in that same city. The Ram al-Shakar thinks even if they aren't living in that city. But the precedent was set up that just like Purim and Hanukkah were set up for the whole Jewish people, individuals should also set up a way of expressing their thanks to God, because the Pesach, Purim, Hanukkah model tells you, the way the Chasam Sofer understands it, is that there is a biblical obligation to do something. Right? He says, it doesn't matter what, right? What you do is up to you. Right? That's the rabbinic part of it. But the fact that you, the notion that you have to find a way of commemorating a miracle, he thinks is a biblical principle, right? That's what he says in 6. And that's what he derives from the Pesach, Purim, Chanukah continuum. So this sort of analysis is what the halachic, you know, authorities, the poskim, used in 1948, 1967,
yes,
when
some... So
what? What?
They relied on the Chatam Sofer.
Yes, they quoted this Chatam Sofer.
This is probably didn't realize that he was.
He's before this minute. Yeah, but he did it anyways. But I mean, the Chatam Sofer was a very novel posek. He was also rhetorically very powerful. But yes, this analysis of the Chasam Sofer became the basis of the Tshuvot in 48 and 67 to justify the institution of Yom HaTzmud and Yom Yerushalayim. And right, it doesn't take much explanation why. Right, once you have the Chasam Sofer, that there's a biblical obligation to set up some sort of recognition, some sort of holiday when a miracle, definitely a national miracle, happens. That's what Purim and Hanukkah tell you. That's what the institutions tell you. So the leap is not that great. Now, they do add a caveat, right? They had to add one more thing to it, which is the Rambam in the first half of 7. Right? The second half of 7, we just noted from Rabbi Soloveitchik that Hanukkah itself is based on Purim. But what the Rambam notes in the beginning of source 7 is that Hanukkah teaches you something that Purim does not quite. Right, and that's what he writes here. Right, b'vay sheni shemalchu yavan gazru gzeirot al Yisrael uvatlu datam v'lonicho otam lasok b'torah mitzvah. He tells the whole story. They didn't let them learn Torah, etc., etc. I mean, he tells the whole story. But if you look at the second to last line, he says what happens after voshiu Yisrael miadam. Jews were saved. V'hemidu melech manakohanim. The king came back, right? This time it was from the Kohanim. The Chazra Malchut Yisrael, yet there are 200 shana ad Korban Hasheni. And the kingship, the reign, was returned to the Jewish people for 200 years until the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. Now, the second thing they add is this detail from the Rambam, right? Hanukkah is unique because, right, this comes back to your question. Are Hanukkah and Purim really relevant nowadays? Right? They're not in the direct sense relevant. I mean, like, yes, we're alive because we didn't die in the time of Purim. But the Rambam writes, at least Hanukkah, even though we know that it came to an end, right? It was a 200-year period where we had independence, but then we lost it again. Still, the message of Hanukkah was important enough, was national enough, that it warranted a holiday, even though the gula was incomplete, right? We knew it was going to end, right? And the Hashemite kings were not particularly righteous kings either, but we got back some sort of political sovereignty for 200 years. So the poskim didn't just need the Chasam Sofer, because they needed to respond to a second claim, was even if there was a miracle that we got, you know, the Jewish state in 48, and in 67 we got Yerushalayim, and we fought incredible odds, still you have to answer the critique, well, okay, but what we got was a secular state without full sovereignty. Is that considered a miracle enough? So to that, they added this Rambam. The Rambam said, yeah. I mean, Hanukkah, whatever it was that was important about Hanukkah, it was important despite the fact that it was temporary, and despite the fact that it wasn't a perfect reign. The simple fact that there was a miracle that led to us regaining sovereignty on a national level was sufficient to make a miracle despite all the drawbacks that the Hasmonean kingdom had.
The geographical territory they controlled was also a lot smaller.
Right, it was a small territory. It was a, you know, corrupt kingdom, and it was temporary. But despite that, because the importance simply of regaining sovereignty was enough to create a holiday. So that leads to, I could have quoted 100 different poskim, but I just took this one in 8 because I had the translation from it, from the Yom Ha'atzmaut Machzor by Karen. I was lucky enough to be the editor of the essay section. So when I wanted to give this year, so I took one of the articles that quotes it, and I emailed Roy Ronnie Ziegler to send me the article which translates a lot of these sources, whichever one I had the translation of, I took. So Rav Meshulam Rath, who was a posek at that time, right? He came to Israel in 49, but he was involved already in the Zionist movement before that. He was born in 1875 in Poland. So in his Shu'at Kol Mavasser, he summarizes basically the argument. We can even just look at the English and you'll see how it comes out. And he says, second paragraph, right, first paragraph is just his bio. He says, it is obvious in our case, which is relevant to the entire community of Israel and includes deliverance from slavery to freedom. We were redeemed from the subjugation of kingdoms and we have become free men and have achieved political independence as well as deliverance from death to life. We were saved, meaning Hanukkah and Purim. We were saved from the hands of our enemies who sought to exterminate. Certainly, we have an obligation to institute a holiday. And it was proper that it was established specifically on this day, which was the central miracle, that we went from slavery to freedom through the Declaration of Independence. And really, all he did was he took the Chasam Sofers, right, traced it, Pesach, Purim, Hanukkah, right? Purim and Hanukkah teach us two different aspects of this. Combine them and you get Yom Ha'atzmaut, and you get, according to the Chasam Sofer, a biblical obligation to set up some sort of holiday to commemorate the miracles of Yom Ha'atzmaut, that we celebrate on Yom Ha'atzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim. And this really became a standard argument in the religious Zionist world. And if you look in 10, right, this is from Reb Chaim Drukman, who's alive nowadays, right, in his article justifying the religious significance of Yom Ha'atzmaut, he writes, the many into the hands of the few, right? Rabim Miyad Me'atem, on the eve of the Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel, the Arab countries declared that within a week they intended to wipe out the entire Yeshuv in the land of Israel. The Arab army's proclamation, we will drive you into the sea, was not a figure of speech, but rather a serious threat to invade the land of Israel from the north, east, south, so that the Mediterranean Sea to the west would be the Jews' last refuge. Is there a better example of the many into the hands of the few? On Hanukkah, we repeatedly recite the Al Nisim prayer, in which we thank God for delivering the many into the hands of the few. The Hanukkah miracle took place more than 2,000 years ago, but this wondrous event has happened also in our time. God delivered the many into the hands of the few and thus saved us from certain death and gave us the gift of our own lives. Is it not appropriate that we thank Him for this? And this becomes a standard argument to justify why Yom Ha'atzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim, according to the Chasam Sofer, are in fact biblical obligations and had to be set up. And this, the Kol Mavasser being from the time when they instituted it, and Rav Drukman being currently alive, reflecting the dominant thought that has continued in the religious Zionist world, used this model to explain why we have a Chag, why we set up a new holiday. In 9, David Berger, Professor David Berger, adds, I think, an important caveat to this. And he notes that if we choose to not set up a holiday, not only would we, let's say, fail to fulfill this biblical obligation that the Chasam Sofer argues for, and I think it's quite compelling, he says it's more than that. If you deny the miracle of, let's say, the Six-Day Wars, what he's talking about here, it's not just that you show ingratitude. He says if you can look at a miracle like that and deny that it was a miracle, not recognize it, you're denying something even more fundamental to Judaism, which is the very notion that God is involved in history. Right? Mm-hmm. We don't like pointing to that event, like the little things that you sometimes hear, like everything is hashgacha pratis, I stuck my hand into my pocket and I got the right coin out and things like that. Right? We can, the Rishonim didn't love talking about that type of hashgacha pratis. But the fact that in the big things, God is involved in history is the very basic that everybody believed in Hashgacha, that when you see something that seems miraculous happening to the entire Jewish people, to deny that God is involved is to deny that God is involved in anything. So to not celebrate it would be a denial of the very basic tenets of Judaism. So in this symposium that he wrote in 92, 25 years after the Six-Day War, he writes as follows. In determining whether a particular historical event is a miracle, context is almost everything. For the non-believer, the context of faith is entirely absent. For such a person, the Israeli capture of Jerusalem, the unraveling of communism, the events of the Gulf War can reasonably be attributed to social, political, military, economic factors. Where faith is present, context takes on a broader meaning encompassing both theology and historical evaluation. Do I believe that God intervenes frequently, even in everyday affairs, a relatively little moment? Do I think that this is a period of Hester Panim, in which natural processes almost invariably prevail? Do I consider divine intervention more likely in Jewish history than in the affairs of the nations of the world? Do I assign a positive, negative, or neutral evaluation to the event under consideration? Do I regard it as a passing episode or as a critical development in human history? Although God's knowledge is unlimited and the possibility of his intervention is always present, many major authorities have maintained that miraculous intervention in the daily lives of ordinary Jews is relatively infrequent, and some degree of uncertainty extends to larger matters as well. I'm inclined to believe, for example, that God had something to do with the low casualty rate following the launching of Scud missiles toward Israel, but I do not feel that my faith requires the categorical affirmation that he changed the flight path of a particular missile or caused its warhead to malfunction. Nonetheless, there are events that are so earth-shaking within the context of Jewish belief that the failure to attribute them to divine intervention leaves Judaism bereft of meaningful faith in the God of Chazal and of the prophets. The establishment of the State of Israel and the capture of Jerusalem are such events. Given the most fundamental assumptions about providence, the goodness of God, and his concern for the Jewish people, the position that developments of such magnitude came about wholly through the workings of an impersonal historical process is inadmissible. It banishes God from history and declares, in effect, that the Lord has forsaken the earth. If the hand of God is not to be found in these events, where is it to be found? One of the great ironies in contemporary Jewish piety is that many deeply religious Jews, he doesn't pull his punches, have inverted the hierarchy of providential events. For many non-Zionist Orthodox Jews, the operation of microprovidence is taken for granted to the point where innumerable events in the lives of prominent rabbis are confidently regarded as miracles. At the same time, the return to the land of Israel, to the Jewish people, is assigned no religious value whatsoever. It is true that God intervenes to protect the land. He guides Scud missiles to targets of brick and stone in large measure because of the merit generated by students studying in Israeli yeshivot. Nonetheless, he appears to have played no role in the establishment of the state. This position is so incongruous that it is rarely, if ever, formulated in such stark terms. Nevertheless, I believe that it is a fair extrapolation from the rhetoric and behavior of many religious Jews. The next line is worse, which I cut out, but the next line is that many of those same people insist that the Holocaust is an act of divine providence punishing the sinners. And he said to think that the Holocaust is an act of hashkacha and not the state of Israel is, right, he has even harsher words than he has over here. But what David Berger argues, I think, which is sort of, you know, when you look at it, pretty straightforward, is that it's more than just what the Chasam Sofer says, that it's a lack of gratitude, right? If, as skeptical as you want to be of all of the, you know, Hashkacha Pratis stories, right, and David Berger is, right, if you deny the big events have anything to do with Hashkacha, then you've turned the notion of Hashkacha on its head. Because the way the Rambam, for example, understands Hashkacha, God does not affect the details. He lets it run by nature. But the big things God is involved with, that is the basics of Tanakh, that the Nevi'im are looking and saying the big historical events are run by God. To not celebrate those big events is to deny the God of history. I mean, right, so that's his sort of theological addition to this halachic argument. So if you take it together, what you had in Yom HaTzimut and Yerushalayim is really a direct, right, is the argument that the messages of Tanakh from Pesach to Purim to Hanukkah, right, have to manifest themselves in personal lives and for sure in our national life. And if you don't, you undermine the basics, A, of the obligation to have Hakaras HaDov, of gratitude to God, and even more so, you deny the notion that God is involved in history, which is an even more sort of severe theological problem. So that is how the Poskim got, halachically and theologically, from Pesach, Purim, Chanukah, and specifically Purim being the paradigm, to the ability to create and the chiyuv to create new holidays in response to modern miracles. So that's just sort of a snapshot of the halachic argumentation that happened in 48 and 67. And, you know, to the continuing relevance of Purim as a halachic model. Okay.
It's interesting, this comment here that sorry, I lost it. Most people don't want to maintain that God intervenes in all kinds of little daily things. I'm sure all of us can think back in our own lives about things which have happened where we can sort of feel that God has sort of intervened in our lives. But I would never, for example, for myself, I would never go around saying publicly any statement like that, because I think it would be a lot of chutzpah on my part, or anybody else. That's why we don't do it.
We probably lock you up.
Right, so I think he actually writes carefully here, right, that he, you know, he's not necessarily opposed to the possibility of detailed hashgacha pratis. He just thinks that in the local, it's hard to affirm categorically,
right
that God did it. In the big things, it's easier to affirm categorically.
A lot of people feel, well, God is not going to bother with that because he's got bigger things in his mind, so to speak. Or there are so many people in the world. How's he going to deal with every little person?
Well, that's basically what he's alluding to. That's, yeah, in fact, what the Rambam says.
But people aren't thinking that God, in this way, is a little bit like a computer, let's say, which doesn't, well, it has to finish one job before it does the other, but it does all these jobs simultaneously.
Right, but that's basically, the Rambam's theology is basically what you just said. The Rambam basically said the details of the world God doesn't get involved in directly.
Well, he doesn't have to get involved in, but he's...
Okay,
so that's the Rambam's opinion, so...
No, but he's alluding to the fact that there are significant positions within the Rishonim who don't... are not convinced by modern notions of Hashgacha Pratis, but they are by these historical processes.
For example, in Yonah, one of the very important lessons which Yonah learns is that God does intervene, even in, like, after he delivers his message and he's sitting outside waiting to see what's going to happen, God sends him the Kikayon to make him feel better. And he's happy because it's not just because he's shaded, but because he feels that, God really still cares about me. And that's really one of the messages.
Well, it could be, or the message of Yonah could be that God. Well, yeah, but you could always read that the other way and say that no, God is intervening to teach Yonah lessons so that he can effectively be a prophet, right? He's a national figure. What he learns personally is part of how he's going to relate to the people of Nineveh and the Jewish people. So, right? So it's not a. Remember, right? His argument isn't, I'm doing this for you. It's, you have mercy on this. This is why I have mercy on people, right? He's teaching Yonah a national lesson.
Yeah, yes.
So pointing to Yonah isn't necessarily a great proof that God, you know. Now,
this argument's fine. I don't have any problem with the argument.
Correct. Right. It doesn't mean that the.
I'm not even there where I'm saying God is too busy with details to worry about individual lives. I wouldn't go that far myself.
Correct. Well, I mean, he's not necessarily taking a position on that. He's saying that the same people who are totally convinced of sort of that type of Hashgacha Pratis should definitely be convinced by the Hashgacha Pratis that everyone agrees to.
Right?
He doesn't need to take a position on whether God gets involved in the details. He can take the Rambam's position, or he could not take the Rambam's position. Or he could take at least one version of the Ramban. He doesn't think the Ramban actually means it, but he has another article on that. But sure, he could. Right, he could take the position that God is involved in every detail. But even the people who think that God isn't involved in every detail do think he's involved in history, right? So his argument is, if you know, for a community, I mean, he's taking a few shots at the yeshivish community, who has book after book called "Nothing is a Coincidence" and "Nothing Happens by Accident" and "The Little Things" and whatever that, you know, it's a small world after all, and whatever, you know, I can think of 100 different books of titles like that, right? To focus so much on, you know, I met this person at this time who knew my cousin, and therefore he, you know, but not, right, and like I'm referring to actual stories, but to ignore the big picture is counterintuitive, and, right, that doesn't mean that it's not true, right, it could be that Hashgacha Pratis does work that way, right, you don't need to take a stand. Right, it's a Kal Vachomer. It's everyone agreed to that, like short of the Ralbag, right? Like short of, you know, but every mainstream position ever has thought that God is involved in history, right? So to have a community which is so focused on Hashgacha Pratis, Hashgacha Pratis, Hashgacha Pratis in the little things where...
Ignore these.
But to ignore the big things is counterintuitive, because one of them is not... Like, even if you want to take that position, God definitely cares more about, let's say, the entirety of the Jewish people and the course of history than he does about, you know, the little things, if you can talk about more and less with God. But, you know, whatever, as a matter of speaking, let's say.
So how do the anti-Zionists answer this?
I don't know if they've ever tried talking to David Berger. They wouldn't win. One does not win a debate with David Berger.
Okay.
I once had the privilege of being on a panel where it was David Berger and me responding to a paper at an academic conference together because we were at a Tikva conference. So I was a fellow and he was the academic advisor. That was, you know, bloody. Like, you don't take on David Berger ever. Mm-hmm. But the answer is they probably... You know, I've never talked to him.
Okay, or just forget about David Berger. I mean, just the application of the Chatam Sofer to the modern day event of the creation of the state of Israel.
I mean, so if you look at, like, you know, the Satmar Rebbe, let's say it's a you know, to Maisa Satan or something, and you know, David Berger.
Why? Because it was created by a secular Jew.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't say I find it compelling. And the Haredi world until recently, besides for like extremes like the Satmar Rebbe, also celebrated some form of Yom HaAtzmaut. Just those pieces tended to be edited out. Mm-hmm. Like there's a famous letter by the Telzer Mashkiach, by Israel Meir Bloch, where he wrote about the obligation for everyone to celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut because you recognize God's miracle. If you don't, it's you know, you're kafui tova, and it was republished in a book, Darkei Shalom Be'emet or something that's like or Pirkei Shalom is like 600 pages long, but it's buried there in the middle in original versions of it. But it was excised of later versions. I only happened to find it because I like came in the Gush Library. Rabbi Leo Young's daughter donated his private library, and the author had sent him an original copy. And you can find the letter in the middle, and the librarian happened to show it to me. But he said that there was a big fight over it when it came out, because you know, no one wanted to admit it. So there were, the Rabbanim in that community really did, for a long time, recognize, and slowly it receded, but it was much more mainstream, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, let's say, to accept this argument, even if you didn't choose to be a religious Zionist, to say that you still have to recognize the miracle. It became less common.
The original Hanukkah and the Purim, even though they may have said the following year, yeah, we got to start celebrating it, but did it become universal all at once? I mean, I'm sure, especially with, you know...
Right. Well, with Purim, we know that it... with Purim, at least Chazal understood that it didn't, right? That it was a big fight, mm-hmm. right? That you know, that Mordechai and Esther had to fight for it.
It takes a while till everyone comes around.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what... I mean, the Megillah itself describes a little bit of that, whereas it took the combination of Megillah of Mordechai and Esther's power to convince people, and Chazal view this as a big fight, right? Chizvuni Ladorish, where she had to command people and argue for it, and they didn't want to do it. So, yes, it you know, the way Chazal understands it, it's always been a fight, it always will be a fight. That's for sure true. In which case, it can act as a precedent yet again.
A technical question. This is sort of the precedent for setting post-biblical holidays, but in the case of Purim and Hanukkah, there's specific proactive mitzvot, and in these other examples that you cited, there's other than proclaiming a national day, there's no real mitzvot.
In Yom HaAtzmaut. So Hallel is really what they do, right? I mean, the reason that they specifically instituted Hallel was because that's what the Gemara says, right? That the Gemara, and this comes back, that Megillah acts as Hallel, but Hallel is the very minimum that we set up, right? Some way of expressing it, right? So on Purim, we have Megillah, which takes the place of Hallel, and Hanukkah, we have Hallel. And otherwise, you know, I don't know, Tachon or something. But that's what the Chassam Sofer says, right? These details are not important as much as, specifically Hallel, he thinks is important, and that's the one thing they institute, right? Because Hallel is the very minimum, it's the expression of thanks. Mm-hmm. What else you do, he says, is left up to the rabbis of the generation. But that was what they set up. They set up Hallel. I didn't know Tachon and whatever else they set up.
Right.
Okay.